4. The bells rang out a dozen times, and then a dozen more. They went on and on until Kel lost count, far past the hours in a day, a week, a month. The persistent sound could only mean one thing. The royals had arrived. Kel stood on his balcony and watched them come. It had been 6 years since London last played host to the Essentosh, but he still remembered watching the procession of ships and people, trying to imagine where they'd come from, what they'd seen. He couldn't go to the world, but on these rare occasions it seemed to come to him. Now, as he watched the ships drift up the aisle, as far as Rye's floating stadiums would allow, he found himself wondering which one Lila would choose for herself. There were a handful of smaller private crafts, but most were massive vessels, luxury boats designed to transport wealthy merchants and nobles from Pharaoh and Vesk to the festivities in the Arnesian capital. All ships bore a mark of origin, on either sail or side, the painted symbol of their crown. That, along with a scroll of approval, would grant them access to the docks for the length of the Essentosh. Would Lila prefer an elegant silverwood ship, like the one bearing the Pharaoh and Mark? Or something bolder, like the vibrantly painted Vescan vessel now approaching? Or a proud Arnesian craft, with dark polished wood and crisp sails? Come to think of it, did Lila even know how to sail? Probably not. But if anyone could make the strange seem ordinary, the impossible look easy, it was Delilah Bard. "What are you smacking at?" asked Rye, appearing beside him. "Your stadiums are making a mess of the river."
"Nonsense," said Rye. "I've had temporary docks erected on the northern and southern banks on both sides of the city. There's plenty of room."
Kyle nodded at the aisle. "Tell that to our guests." Below, the other vessels had parted to make way for the Vescan fleet as it came up the river, stopping only when it reached the barricade. The Vescan Royal Barge, a splendid rig made of redwood with dark sails bearing the royal emblem of the crow in flight against a white moon, was flanked by two military ships. Minutes later, the Pharaoh's imperial vessel followed, its ships all skeletal and silver-white, the crest of the black trees scorched into their sails.
"We should get going," said the prince. "We'll have to be there to welcome them."
"We?" echoed Kel, even though the king had already made it clear that his presence was required. Not because Kel was family, he thought bitterly, but because he was Aven, a symbol of Arnesian power.
"They'll want to see you," the king had said,
and Kel had understood. When Maxim said "you," he didn't mean Kel the person, he meant Kel the Antari. He bristled. Why did he feel like a trophy? Or worse, a trinket?
"Stop that," chided Rye.
"Stop what?"
"Whatever's going through your head that has you frowning even more than usual. You'll give us both wrinkles."
Kel sighed.
"Come," pressed Rye. "There's no way I'm facing them on my own."
"Which one are you afraid of? Lord Solinar?"
"Cora."
"The Vescan princess?" Kel laughed.
"She's just a child." "She was just a child, and a nightmarish one at that. But I've heard she's grown into something truly fearsome."
Kel shook his head. "Come on, then," he said, slinging his arm around the prince's shoulder. "I'll defend you."
"My hero."
The Red Palace had 5 halls. The Grand, an extravagant 3-story ballroom made of polished wood and sculpted crystal. The Gold, a sprawling reception hall, all stone and precious metal. The Jewel, seated at the palace heart and made entirely of glass. The Sky, on the roof, its mosaic floor glittering under the sun and stars. And the Rose. The last of these, positioned near the front of the palace and accessed through its own hall and doors, possessed a stately elegance. It had been built in a wing of the palace with nothing overhead, and light shone through windows set into the ceiling. The walls and floor were royal marble, pale stone threaded with garnet and gold, crafted by mineral mages for the crown's use alone. In place of columns, bouquets of flowers in their massive urns cut parallel lines through the chamber. Between these columns, a gold runner ran from doorway to dais and throne. The Rose Hall was where the crown held court with its people, and where it intended to greet its neighboring royals. If they ever showed up. Kel and Rye stood on either side of the thrones, Rye leaning against his father's chair, Kel at attention beside the queen's. Master Tyrion stood at the front of the dais, but he wouldn't meet Kel's gaze. Was it his imagination, or had the Avan Essen been avoiding him? The royal guards stood statuesque in their gleaming armor, while a select assembly of Ostra and Vestra milled about, having drifted into clusters to chat. It had been more than an hour since the royal ships had docked, and an escort had been sent to accompany them to the palace. Sparkling wine sat on trays, going flat with the weight. Rye shifted from foot to foot, clearly tense. This was, after all, his first time at the helm of a royal affair, and while he'd always been one for details, they usually centered on his clothing or his hair. The Essen Tosh was on another scale entirely. Kel watched him fidget with the gleaming gold seal of the Maresh, a chalice and rising sun, over his heart. He'd produced a second one for Kel, which he had reluctantly pinned on the breast of his red coat. King Maxim fiddled with a coin, something Kel only saw him do when he couldn't sit still. Like his father before him, Maxim Maresh was a metal worker, a strong magician in his own right, though he had little need of it now. Still, Kel had heard the stories of Maxim's youth, tales of the Steel Prince who forged armies and melted hearts, and he knew that even now the king traveled twice a year to the borders to stoke the fires of his men.
"I hope nothing has happened to our guests," said King Maxim.
"Perhaps they got lost," mused Rye.
"We could only be so lucky," murmured Kel. Queen Emira shot them both a look, and Kel almost laughed. It was such simple motherly scorn. At last, the trumpets sounded, and the doors swung open.
"Finally," muttered Rye.
"Princess Cole and Princess Cora,"
announced a servant, his voice echoing through the hall,
"of the House Tascan, ruling family of Vesk."
The Tascan siblings entered, flanked by a dozen attendants. They were striking, dressed loosely in green and silver, with elegant cloaks trailing behind. Cole was 18 now, Cora 2 years his junior.
"Your Majesties," said Prince Cole,
a burly youth in heavily accented Arnesian.
"We are welcomed to your city,"
added Princess Cora with a curtsy and a cherubic smile. Kel shot Rye a look that said, "Honestly? This is the girl you're so afraid of?" Rye shot him one back that said, "You should be too." Kel gave Princess Cora another more appraising glance. The princess hardly looked strong enough to hold a wine flute. Her cascades of honey-blonde hair were done up in an elaborate braid that circled her head like a crown, woven through with emeralds. She was slight for a Vescan, tall, yes, but narrow-waisted, willowy in a way that would have better suited the Arnesian court. Rye had been allowed to accompany his mother to the Essen Tosh in Vesk 3 years before, so he'd seen her grow. But Kel, confined to the city, had only seen the tournament on years when Arnes was called to host. When the games were held there 6 years ago, Prince Cole had come, along with one of his other brothers. The last time Kel had seen Cora, 12 years ago, she'd been a small child. Now her pale blue eyes traveled up, landing on his two-toned gaze, and stuck. He was so accustomed to people avoiding his eyes, their own glancing off, finding safer ground, that the intensity caught him off guard, and he fought the sudden urge to look away. Meanwhile, an attendant carried a large object, shrouded in heavy green cloth, to the throne dais, and set it down on the step. Whisking the cloth away with a dramatic flare, the attendant revealed a bird inside a cage. Not a multicolored mimic or a songbird, both favored by the Arnesian court, but something more predatory. It was massive and silvery gray, save for its head, which had a plume and collar of black. Its beak looked razor sharp.
Thank you, announced Prince Cole, for inviting us into your home.
Cole shared Cora's coloring, but nothing else. Where she was tall, he was taller. Where she was narrow, he was built like an ox. A handsome one, but still there was something bullish about his attitude and expression.
Gratitude, said the king, nodding to Master Tyrion, who strode forward and lifted the cage.
It would go to the sanctuary, Kell supposed, or be set free. A palace was no place for wild animals. Kell tracked the exchange out of the corner of his eye, his attention still leveled on the princess, whose gaze was still leveled on him, too, as if transfixed by his black eye. She looked like the kind of girl who would point to something, or someone, and say, "I want one of those." The thought was almost amusing, until he remembered Astrid's words, "I would own you, flower boy." And then the humor turned cold. Kell took a slight, almost imperceptible step back.
"Our home shall be yours," King Maxim was saying. It all felt like a script. "And if the gods favor us," said Prince Cole with a grin, "so shall your tournament."
Rye bristled, but the king simply laughed.
"We shall see about that,"
he said with a hearty smile that Kell knew was false. The king didn't care for Prince Cole or any of the Beskan royal family, for that matter. But the real danger lay with Pharaoh, with Lord Solinar. As if on cue, the trumpets sounded again, and the Beskan entourage took up their glasses of wine and stepped aside.
"Lord Solinar, Regent of Pharaoh," announced the attendant as the doors opened.
Unlike the Veskans, whose entourage surrounded them, Solinar strode in at the front, his men filing behind him in formation. They were all dressed in Pharaohan style, a single piece of fabric intricately folded around them, the tail end cast back over one shoulder like a cape. His men all wore rich purple, accented in black and white, while Solinar wore white, the very edges of the fabric trimmed in indigo. Like all ranking Pharaohans, he was clean-shaven, affording a full view of the beads set into his face. But unlike most, who favored glass or precious gems, Lord Solinar's ornamentation appeared to be white gold, diamond-shaped slivers that traced curved paths from temples to throat. His black hair was trimmed short, and a single larger teardrop of white gold stood out against his forehead, just above his brows, marking him as royal. "How do they choose?" Rye had wondered aloud years before, holding a ruby to his forehead. "I mean, Father says the number of gems is a social signifier, but apparently the color is a mystery. I doubt it's arbitrary. If it were the Veskins, maybe. But nothing about the Pharaohans seems arbitrary, which means the colors must mean something."
"Does it matter?" Kell had asked wearily.
"Of course it does," snapped Rye. "It's like knowing there's a language you don't speak and having no one willing to teach it to you."
"Maybe it's private."
Rye tipped his head and furrowed his brow to keep the ruby from falling.
"How do I look?"
Kell had snorted.
"Ridiculous."
But there was nothing ridiculous about Lord Solinar. He was tall, several inches taller than the men of his guard, with a chiseled jaw and rigid gait. His skin was the color of charcoal, his eyes pale green and sharp as cut glass. Older brother to the King of Pharaoh, commander of the Pharaohan fleet, responsible for the unification of the once dispersed territories and considered to be the majority of the actual thinking behind the throne. And unable to rule for lack of magic. He more than made up for it with his military prowess and keen eye for order, but Kell knew the fact made Rye uneasy.
"Welcome, Lord Solinar," said King Maxim.
The Ferrowan regent nodded, but did not smile. "Your city shines," he said simply. His accent was heavy and smooth, like a river stone. He flicked his hand, and two attendants carried forward a pair of potted saplings, their bark an inky black. The same trees that marked the Ferrowan royal seal, just as the bird was the symbol of Vesk. Kel had heard of the Ferrowan birch, rare trees said to have medicinal, even magical properties.
"A gift," he said smoothly, "so that good things may grow."
The king and queen bowed their heads in thanks, and Lord Solinar's gaze swept across the dais, passing Rye and landing for only a moment on Kel, before he bowed and stepped back. With that, the king and queen descended their thrones, taking up glasses of sparkling wine as they did. The rest of the room moved to echo the motion, and Kel sighed. Standing there on display was painful enough. Now came the truly unfortunate task of socializing. Rye was clearly steeling himself against the princess, who had apparently spent their last encounter trying to steal kisses and weave flowers in his hair. But Rye's worrying turned out to be for nothing. She had her sights set on other prey.
"Kings," swore Kel in his head, gripping his wine flute as she approached.
"Prince Kel," she said, flashing a childlike grin.
He didn't bother to point out that she should address him as master, not prince.
"You will dance with me at the evening balls."
He wasn't sure if her Arnesian was simply limited or if she meant to be so direct. But Rye shot him a look that said he'd spent months preparing for this tournament, that it was a display of politics and diplomacy, that they would all be making sacrifices, and that he'd rather stab himself than let Kel put the Empire's peace in jeopardy by denying the princess a dance. Kel managed a smile and bowed.
"Of course, Your Highness," he answered, adding in Vesken, "Gradach an Ach."
"It is my pleasure." Her smile magnified as she bobbed away to one of her attendants. Rye leaned over.
"Looks like I'm not the one who needs protecting after all. You know," he sipped his wine, "it would be an interesting match."
Kel kept his smile fixed.
"I will stab you with this pin. You would suffer. It would be worth..."
He was cut off by the approach of Lord Solinar.
"Prince Rye," said the regent, nodding his head.
Rye straightened and then bowed deeply.
"Lord Solinar," he said. "Hasanal Rasnavaras Ahas."
"Your presence honors our kingdom."
The regent's eyes widened in pleased surprise.
"Amun Shahar,"
he said, before shifting back to Arnesian.
"Your Ferrowan is excellent."
The prince blushed. He had always had an ear for languages. Kel knew a fair amount of Ferrowan, too, thanks to Rye preferring to have someone to practice on, but he said nothing.
"You make the effort to learn our tongue," said Rye. "It is only respectful to reciprocate."
And then, with a disarming smile, he added,
"Besides, I've always found the Ferrowan language to be beautiful."
Solinar nodded, his gaze shifting toward Kel.
"And you," said the regent, "you must be the Arnesian Antari."
Kel bowed his head, but when he looked up, Solinar was still examining him, head to toe, as if the mark of his magic were not drawn only to his eye, but across every inch of his being. When at last his attention settled on Kel's face, he frowned faintly, the drop of metal on his forehead glinting.
"Namunost," he murmured.
"Fascinating." The moment Solinar was gone, Kel finished his wine in a single gulp, and then retreated through the open doors of the Rose Hall before anyone could stop him. He'd had more than enough royals for one day.